The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got an awesome show for you today. In this half hour, we're going to be interviewing Rabbi Joseph Tulushkin, who is the author of what is now the best-selling book, Rebbe, The Life and Teachings of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the most influential rabbi in modern history. I'd take it back even more than that, too. A once-in-a-millennia-type individual. We've got wonderful music for you today. Beautiful stuff. The portion of the week is the portion of Chukas, chapter 19 and following in the book of Numbers, an awesome story involving the Lubavitcher Rebbe, if we have enough time. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Operation Brothers Keeper, the search for three abducted yeshiva students, is now in its ninth day. The IDF continued to carry out arrests of Hamas members and other terrorists. There is still no sign of their whereabouts of the three boys, Ayel Yifra, Naftali Frankel, and Gilad Shaar. 100 locations in the Hebron area were searched overnight, and about 80 Palestinians who were released in exchange for Gilad Shalit in 2011 were rearrested. In related but non-consequential news, popular 1970s singer Tony Orlando is currently in Israel, and he paid a visit to the families of the three teenagers. Orlando asked his fans to hang three yellow ribbons in solidarity with the youths, like the line from the famous song, Tie a Yellow Ribbon. The Israeli Air Force struck several targets in Gaza, destroying a concealed rocket launcher in two terrorist centers in northern Gaza. Two terrorist centers in central Gaza were also targeted. The strikes came in response to rockets fired from into Israel from Gaza, which, since the Operation Brothers Keeper has been instituted, rockets have been escalating from rocket fire from Gaza has been escalating. Three terrorists, aged 17, 19, and 21, of East Jerusalem, were charged with a severe assault on a police officer in Jerusalem on Jerusalem Day. The three threw rocks at police from a Jerusalem rooftop, putting one soldier in the hospital with severe concussion and temporary blindness. Some interesting, maybe disturbing news. 89-year-old Johann Johnny Breyer of Philadelphia was arrested for aiding murder during his time as a Nazi guard of Auschwitz and Buchenwald. Breyer, a retired toolmaker originally from Czechoslovakia, came to the U.S. in 1952. He's been living okay for over 50 years. Breyer is accused of serving the Waffen-SS Death's Head Guard Battalion from July 1943 to January 1945. And finally, an exhibition of the Jewish Presence Israel opened at UNESCO headquarters in Paris. Book, People, Land, the 3,500-year relationship of the Jewish people with the Holy Land, consists of 30 illustrated panels and texts. The U.S., Israel, Canada, and Montenegro are official co-sponsors of the exhibit. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Hey, Shel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have, as promised, Rabbi Joseph Tolushin, author of Rebbe, The Life and Teachings of Menachem M. Schneerson, the Most Influential Rabbi in Modern History. How are you today, Joe?
I'm very good, and I'm happy to be on with you.
Thank you, thank you. It is indeed our honor. The Jewish Hour has been on air for 18 years, and we've been looking to get Rabbi Joseph Tolushkin on, so we're so happy that you're able to come on. I want to talk really some technical stuff about this book, Rebbe. It's been all over the internet. It's on radio shows already. You've been interviewed all over the place, and people are familiar with already a lot of the text. I want to go into first before into some technical stuff. You're right. It took you about 5 years to write the book Rebbe. So I'm thinking, did you start out saying, I'm going to write a book that's going to take me 5 years to write?
No. I hoped this book was going to take 2 years to write. And while books often do take longer than one originally thinks, I've never had such a discrepancy between my expectation and the reality. But there was so much material out there about the Rebbe, but ironically, for purposes of a biographer, very little material coming from the Rebbe. So it was hard to write a classic biography of the Rebbe. It's not like there were a lot of journals to consult. The Rebbe had hundreds of volumes of his speeches and other things recorded, but he rarely spoke about himself. He was not the sort of person who, you know, liked to throw in anecdotes from his own life. He did it occasionally, but really quite infrequently. So the book had to really involve me in interviewing so many people and going through so many interviews of others that others had done with him. And it therefore took me a while to find my writer's voice, what I really wanted to say, because you don't want the book to come out chaotic.
Mm-hmm. So
you
were
throwing in all the facts.
You weren't planning on having the book come out a month before the Rebbe's 20th anniversary of his passing. It's just
when I initially started on the project, no, because as I said, I started 5 years ago. I thought it would be a 2-year project, and so I thought it would come out perhaps maybe it would come out around 18 years. Then once I realized that it was going to be relatively close to this 20th year, so I knew then that there would be a revival of interest around that time. Mm-hmm. It's not totally coincidental. By the end, I knew that. It did cause me, HarperCollins, my publisher, the publisher of Rebbe, had scheduled a deadline. I don't use the word deadline anymore because the Rebbe thought that the word had a very negative connotation. It's an example where writing about the Rebbe caused me to make a change in my own life. So now instead of deadline, I say due date. And the difference is obviously dramatic, deadline connoting death and due date, you know, connoting life. So HarperCollins had assigned me a due date at the which would have ended up causing the book to be published in another few months during the fall. They also then became aware of the significance of this being the 20th anniversary of the Rebbe's death and urged me to finish the book sooner, so I had a few months of working double time.
Okay, indeed. Let's go back even further than that. The impetus for writing the book, your grandfather was a Lubavitcher. He was also an author. I have at least one book, maybe two books on my shelf by Rabbi Nissen Tolushkin.
Mm-hmm.
Your father was the accountant for corporate Lubavitch, and was besides
also
that
also the personal accountant for the Rebbe.
Personal accountant for the Rebbe. Was this the impetus for you writing the book, or was there something else?
I didn't really grow. You know, I grew up with these very close associations with Chabad, you know, very loving associations, but I wasn't really raised inside the movement. So the impetus was I started to realize increasingly the impact of the Rebbe. Now, remember, even when I started working on the book, it had been quite a number of years since the Rebbe's death. And anybody who's an observer of the Jewish scene, as certainly I am, you know, has been aware of the phenomenon of the incredible growth of Chabad. So if you assess the success of leadership by what happens to a movement after the leader's death, something very pretty unprecedented was happening. It wasn't a question of just keeping the movement at the same size. The movement has had this enormous expansion. And so increasingly I came to realize this is the sort of leader who comes across very, very infrequently. And what was the secret of his message? How is he continuing to inspire people? We're now dealing with a phenomenon that doesn't just affect one part of Jewry, but that has had a tremendous impact on all of Jewry. So the Rebbe, therefore, I suddenly realized this is an historical figure. And certainly worthy of a comprehensive biography, and worthy for me personally of spending a lot of time, because this is somebody from whom there is a lot to be learned.
Indeed, indeed. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, wrote a book called Rebbe, The Life and Teachings of Menachem M. Schneerson. I call him the Lubavitch Rebbe. So how does it work? I mean, there are two other biographies that came out this month. One by Dinsteins, also one by Chaim Miller. And Dinsteins and Chaim Miller have their own publishing companies. Did you go to HarperCollins and say, I'd like to write a book about the Rebbe? And they said, sure, sounds like a good idea to us.
No.
Okay, I didn't think so.
Quite as simply as that. First of all, you know, fortunately, I have been publishing books for quite a while. I believe this is my 19th book. So, and I have fortunately had the opportunity to publish with mainstream presses. Why do I say that that's an advantage? Because their books will be stocked in all sorts of bookstores. Sometimes if you publish with some of the smaller Jewish presses, your books will be carried only in Jewish bookstores. And particularly if you're writing a book that you want to reach out to people who might not be the sort of people who frequent Jewish bookstores, this is the sort of book to do. Having said that, I'm a very big fan of Jewish bookstores because I know that it's becoming increasingly difficult for them financially. So I want to support both. So that's the advantage of having a mainstream publisher. And I also knew that if I went to them at the very beginning of the process, they might not realize the significance of who the Rebbe was and would be less apt to want to buy the book. So I bided my time. I went with my agent, Richard Pine, who's a very successful and commercial agent, and he went to a number of different publishing houses. HarperCollins was not the only one that was interested. There were three houses that expressed some real interest, and I met with editors from those three. But at that point, I had already actually written a draft of quite a substantial part of the book. So they knew what they were getting. They read about it, and it occurred to them that the Rebbe was a more significant figure than perhaps they had understood. I was also blessed. My editor at HarperCollins is a woman who's not Jewish, Karen Rinaldi. But she had heard about the Rebbe over the years. She comes from Brooklyn, so she had heard about the Rebbe, had seen Lubavitcher Hasidim, but she had an associate editor named Jake Zabidi, who had grown up in Miami Beach, where his families were members of the Chabad synagogue there. And so he had a particular interest in seeing this book done, and that's part of the background of how it happened.
Mm-hmm. What kind of encouragement did you get from corporate Lubavitch itself, meaning Lubavitch headquarters in Brooklyn?
They were wonderful. They were very open. I think they were intrigued by the idea of somebody writing a book about the Rebbe who did not come directly from within Chabad, and therefore, as a result, whose other books had been read largely throughout the Jewish community. So, you know, I had written a book, Jewish Literacy, which has been widely read and used in all the different religious denominations. And I think that was intriguing to them and attractive to them because Chabad, understandably, sees the Rebbe as a person who has a message for the whole Jewish community and indeed for the whole world. And they were aware that if something is published internally within Chabad, the way the Rebbe is written about, you know, often written about within the movement, is obviously in a very reverential way that is not as apt to engross people who are not already sort of committed to the Rebbe. So they really gave me access to anybody I wanted to interview. I was never told, you know, that I was never turned down. They gave me access to looking through a lot of the documents that exist. Chabad has, you know, tremendous comprehensive documents. And they did so with the understanding that they would have no editorial control over the book. They gave me, they understood that, you know, I wasn't going to turn the manuscript over to them for them to approve and say, no, this you can't have, because obviously, first of all, that would not be the right thing to do. It certainly wouldn't be right. I would certainly not consent. And also, it would destroy any credibility for the book. So they were willing to not have any editorial control. Now, also, given that they know my family background, you know, I think they had an innate sense of trust. They knew that I was going into this book not to write an expose, God forbid. First of all, it's not easy to write an expose about the Rebbe. I don't know what one's going to expose that would be, God forbid, highly embarrassing or anything, because he lived a pretty pristine life. But they knew that I was going in with an affectionate attitude, which indeed I was. They knew I had areas of disagreement, which indeed I did have. But they knew that I had every intention of being fair. And again, I have an enormous admiration. As I said in the preface to my book, I said, obviously I went into this book with a high regard for the Rebbe. Why else would I want to spend 5 years of my life studying another man's life? And indeed, I learned that by studying his life, I learned lessons applicable to my own life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, again, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Rabbi Joseph Talishkin. He's written a book called Rebbe, The Life and Teachings of Menachem M. Schneerson. So you had an opinion and a feeling about Lubavitch and about the Rebbe. What changed, what was augmented because of your in delving and researching the Rebbe's life and work?
The sense of what a broad-based leader he was. There were a few things that did it. Number one, I had never really fully appreciated the depth of the Chabad outreach, even though I said I was struck by it. But as far as I can ascertain, this represented the first attempt in all of Jewish history to reach every single Jewish community, indeed every single Jew in the world.
Indeed.
Tied in with that was the understanding that the Rebbe, who thought in macro terms, he thought in terms of the large Jewish community, also always remained focused on the individual. I don't know of any other leader of a large movement or of a government who was able, even during his or her maximum years of leadership, to still always remain focused on the individual. Anybody who really wanted to see the Rebbe could eventually get to do so. It might be a brief meeting, but they would have that opportunity for that encounter. And so the Rebbe remained very focused always on individuals. That was another thing that struck me. Also, that his love was really given to the Jewish community in an unconditional manner. So that when people say, oh, you know, Chabad practices, the Rebbe practiced, love your neighbor as yourself. So some people think, okay, but that's always been essential in Judaism. Number one, it's the most famous law in the Torah, that and love the Lord your God are probably the two most famous laws in the Torah. And secondly, in early Jewish history already, or around 2,000 years ago, Hillel and Akiva, two of the most renowned rabbis of the Talmud, said this is the essential law of Judaism. But having said that, in real life, that's not what happened. In real life, the rabbi said the temple was destroyed because of causeless hatred within the Jewish community. And there had always been these fights, even the terrible fights that occurred, the animosity towards the Hasidim in their early years. So the Jewish community has always been filled with a lot of acrimony. It's embarrassing, you know, to an extent it's been embarrassing and it's caused a lot of problems. The Rebbe wanted to overcome it, and he understood intuitively it could only be overcome if love was not made conditional. So when Rabbi Israel Meir Lau, who in later years gained renown as Israel's chief rabbi, but when he met with the Rebbe as a young man, he was early in his rabbinical career, and the Rebbe asked him, what sort of work are you doing? And he said he's involved in Kiruv Rechokim, which is the Hebrew expression that literally means bringing near those who are far away, a euphemistic way of saying of getting non-observant Jews to become more religious Jews. And the Rebbe said, who are we to know who's near and who's far? They're all precious in God's eyes. So he didn't go out to other Jews with the attitude of his, we're the superior people, and we're going to find a way to make you also religious. He appreciated other Jews for who they were and for what they did. There was a group that subsequent to World War II, right after World War II, was called Bricha. It was a group of largely non-traditionally observant Jews who were involved in helping Jews escape from Eastern Europe, which had fallen under communist domination. The Rebbe's wife, known as the Rebbetzin, Chaya Mushka, the daughter of the previous Rebbe, used to refer to those people as tzaddikim without tefillin, righteous people who don't put on tefillin. Now, tzaddikim is about the highest appellation you can apply to anyone in Jewish life, and usually it's associated with a person who's classically pious. But the Rebbe understood that classical piety for them was expressed in love of neighbor in a manner that they were willing to risk their lives in others. So he was willing, and she was willing, to call them tzaddikim. Did they want to encourage them to do more in their lives Jewishly? Of course they did. But the love came first. The love was not made conditional on their making those changes. And very often love is made conditional. If you do this, oh, then you're worthy. And they were willing to give that love first. And when people feel loved, they are much more open to doing more.
Indeed, indeed. If you're if you're just joining us, our guest today is Joseph Telushkin, who's authored a, it's already a bestseller, a book called The Rebbe. It's a biography of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Your grandfather was a disciple of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Your father was an accountant for the Rebbe. So what I'm assuming that you had personal meetings with the Rebbe. I wonder if maybe you might be able to share some of the things that the Rebbe said to you.
I only, unfortunately, only had one. And it was when I was about 19. And the meeting was with my father and grandfather. It was not a short meeting. It was actually about a 40-minute meeting. The unfortunate aspect of it was the meeting was in Yiddish, and my Yiddish is very weak. So my father was sort of whispering the translations to me. Now, obviously, you'll wonder, why was my Yiddish not good? My Hebrew was good. You know, I went to Hebrew-speaking schools, and even in the case of my grandfather, he and I always spoke to each other in Hebrew. So one struck by the eyes of the Rebbe, but, you know, I feel almost, I sound like a broken record when I say that, because that's what struck everybody with the Rebbe. He had a way of looking at you, a profound way, and it was a meeting at that point. It was shortly after the Israeli Six-Day War, and my grandfather, Alav HaShalom, was about to make a trip to Israel, and, you know, and they were speaking about it both in religious and in political senses. And I was about to go. That was the immediate impetus. Also, my father wanted to make sure I came to the visit because I was about to go for a year to learn at a yeshiva in Israel. And I got a bracha from the Rebbe. In retrospect, do I regret that I did not spend more of my time speaking to my father and grandfather about the Rebbe and taking advantage of other opportunities to meet with the Rebbe? That feeling of regret was so prominent during the 5 years I was working on this book. My father, though, you know, was an accountant, and my father was present at the scene because he was at Chabad probably an average of one day a week for 40 years. And, you know, he worked immediately outside where the Rebbe's office was. So he really knew a great deal. And if I had asked specific questions, he would tell me, but my father, you know, was a fairly he was a guarded person. He didn't just talk about things. So
client confidentiality. I mean,
well, that certainly was the case, yes. But I, you know, it wouldn't be that I'd start asking him about, you know, financial matters, but he was aware of all that was going on there. You know, he'd often come back, you know, in the 60s, even in the 50s. I was not so, you know, I was still pretty young because I was born in 48. But, you know, things that were amazing to me, they couldn't understand. You know, people would show up who had just gotten out of Russia and were Talmidei Chachamim, you know, real scholars of Judaism. And my father knew, like everybody knew, that all Jewish schooling had been outlawed in the Soviet Union. So just on the basis of an underground education, people came out very knowledgeable. So we were aware that remarkable things were happening there. But, oh, my regret that I didn't have the opportunity to interview. Obviously, the person you most want to interview if you're writing a biography is the subject himself, the Rebbe. But I somehow have a feeling, even if I had had the opportunity to interview the Rebbe, he's not going to be that forthcoming in discussing, you know, his own personal life. But my father and grandfather, you know, had been at the scene so much, I would have loved to speak to them about the Rebbe. The Rebbe is an exceedingly fascinating figure because he was an introverted person growing up who had to expand and change himself in order to become a leader. But once he did it with full heart. You know, anybody who would watch a videotape of a weekday Verbrengen, obviously when the public meetings were held on Shabbat, they couldn't be videoed. But anybody who would watch a weekday Verbrengen and would see the Rebbe motioning quite very energetically, sometimes wildly with his arms, to increase the singing, the volume of the singing, the passion of the singing, would not imagine that this was an enormously private person whose aspirations in life had not been to be a leader, whose aspirations in life had been to be a scholar, who at a certain point of his life might well have thought that he was going to earn his living as an engineer and do incredible work in Jewish life and in Jewish writing and in Jewish scholarship during the rest of his time. But once he undertook this mission, he developed those parts of himself. One of the fascinating things, there's a chapter in the book about the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin. And the Rebbetzin was as private a person as he, but because she never assumed a leadership role, she was able to stay more private. And so less was known about her, but there too I had the opportunity to interview people who had interactions with her. And you find an extraordinary caring and concern and what I call moral imagination. She did the things. She could imagine what other people needed. And that was also very, very moving to learn about her.
You're talking about the Rebbetzin as the Rebbe's wife as a private person. My wife, with the impetus of a couple of other girls she was learning in Machon Chan at the time, wrote the Rebbetzin if they could meet her. And the Rebbetzin, surprisingly, you know, said yes. And at the end of the meeting, without going into the whole detail, the Rebbetzin said goodbye to them and said, "Of course, you won't tell anybody about this meeting, because otherwise she would just be inundated, and that's not what the Rebbetzin wanted. They didn't want their own private lives."
That's right, yes. And by the way, the Hasidim, as a rule, were exceedingly protective of that.
Indeed.
To the extent that...
Very respectful of that.
Yeah, to the extent that generally if somebody was with the Rebbetzin and her husband came home, people would, you know, would usually run out to give them some private time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I became religious in 1976, and the Rebbetzin passed away in 1988, and I never saw the Rebbetzin. I just never,
wow.
I was never in a place where I ever said, someone said, "Oh, by the way, that's the Rebbetzin." No, I never, I don't know which, aside from the pictures that came out, I have no idea what what she looked like. Because
right,
she,
and there actually are very few pictures. By the way, to the extent that a certain doctor in the neighborhood, I'm forgetting his name, that there was a certain doctor gets a call from a phone number, and he was a doctor who would occasionally make house calls, didn't normally. And the name of the patient who wanted to consult with him was Schneerson. He assumed it might be the Rebbe's house. On the other hand, you know, there are other Schneerson's cousins, you know, within the community. But he said he only knew that it was the Rebbe's house when he came there to treat her. And you know how he knew it?
Go ahead.
Because there was no picture of the Rebbe anywhere in the house. You know, he said he knew enough about Chabad to know if you walk into the house of a Chabadnik, you're going to see a picture of the Rebbe. And there was no pictures there of the Rebbe.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the we could talk about every story that you have in this book, but one of the stories which I had heard before, which showed the Rebbe's caring in individuals, was actually something that happened with your father after he had his stroke and was lying in the hospital. Could you just briefly tell over just
the remarkable incident? And probably now that I think about it, I know this played a very major role in what opened me up to writing this book, because it's one of the most precious memories I and my family, my sister, that we have. In June of 1986, I was living in Israel, and I got a phone call from my mother that my father had had a stroke, and it was clearly a fairly serious stroke. And so I flew home immediately. My father was unconscious and spent, you know, all the time with him. And every day we were getting two phone calls from the Chabad headquarters that the Rebbe wants to know how your father is. And finally, after a few days after I came home, my father did come out of the his state of his coma. And he was a bit disoriented. Sometimes he could be clear, sometimes he could be confused, and the calls continued to come. And then one day I got a call from Rabbi Krinsky, the Rebbe's very close aide, secretary, and he said, the Rebbe, we were having a meeting of the Vod, we were having a meeting of the leadership, and an accounting, a financial matter came up, and the Rebbe said, ask Shlomo, which is my father. And so he said, I have a question for you. So I said, Rabbi Krinsky, you know how sick my father is. He's in ICU. He's in intensive care. He said, of course. He said, we know that. And the Rebbe remembered, but nonetheless, he did have this question. So at that point, I thought, okay, I'll go ask the question. I asked the question. My father looks at me, sort of shrugs a little, if I recall correctly, and says that the answer is obvious, and then he gives the answer. At that moment, I was profoundly, profoundly moved because I realized what had happened. Here's the Rebbe sitting at his desk in Brooklyn dealing with very significant, massive issues of Jews in different communities, you know, all sorts of very big issues. And he obviously also was thinking about one person, my father, who's lying in a hospital bed having suffered a bad stroke, who's probably feeling very disoriented and very sad and feeling that his life of creativity and his useful life is coming to an end. And so he comes up with a question that he sensed my father could answer. Now, did his awareness that my father could answer it, did it come from the fact that he had, you know, he could channel and know things that the rest of us couldn't know? Was it a question just that he used an extraordinary amount of common sense, or as I called it earlier, moral imagination? Whatever it was, he had a question, and my father was able to answer it. And by doing so, the fact that my father lying there like that, the Rebbe is still consulting with him about a question, obviously was a very powerful experience for my father. And from that point on, it was just not a question then of having, you know, knowing the Rebbe was a major figure, having a lot of admiration for him. Obviously, it evoked in me an enormous sense of gratitude and affection. And so I wrote a book. I wrote an article on the 12th anniversary of the Rebbe's death for the Forward, the Jewish newspaper. And I told that story in it. And that was part of the whole process that brought me to, that made me aware that here was truly the subject for a big and important book, because this is a man who fashioned a big and important movement. Now, remember, I hadn't really written biographies before. Most of my books are in different aspects of Jewish life. So that wasn't my natural genre. I had written a book. I had helped a man, a friend of mine, Danny Abraham, write a memoir. And I had written a book on Hillel. But Hillel was an easier subject to write about. One of the reasons is there's no mention of Hillel outside of the Talmudic Midrashic literature. So as a result, all the material about him is contained, you know, is
easier subject to work with.
Right. Whereas here, everything had to be basically searched out, documented. And I had the additional problem for a writer that I'm writing about a man who is not an obscure man. The details of his life might not be that well known. On the other hand, you have several thousand very loyal Hasidim, you know, in the whose favorite activity is exchanging stories about the Rebbe. The biggest, the hardest thing for me in a way to do was to find a story that I could authenticate and that the Hasidim did not know. I was very averse to including anonymous material, because anonymous material, frankly,
can't be verified.
You don't know whether it's accurate or not. You know, even if it's basically accurate, it could be widely exaggerated. So I almost always wanted to have somebody who was willing to say they knew this as a fact to be true.
Mm-hmm. Good. Anyway, last question. Are you surprised with the book's initial success? Harper wrote, according as of Friday morning, Harper Collins says that there's 55,000 volumes in print. You're in on
that. Wait, how many do they say is in print now?
55,000.
Okay. I am surprised. I'm pleasantly surprised. I'm not shocked. I was very pleasantly surprised that the book is now, the New York Times now, and when it releases its list, it's part of the Times bestseller list. Publishers Weekly, it was number 6, you know, in its first week of publication. This has just been extraordinarily gratifying for a writer, because I really did want to write a book that would help introduce the Rebbe to an even broader audience. When I was interviewed on a friend of mine's program, Dennis Prager, you know, and Dennis was, who's most of whose listenership are not Jewish, and he said, listen, there are things for non-Buddhists to learn when they read about the Dalai Lama, and there's a lot for non-Jews as well to learn when they read about the Rebbe. In fact, oddly enough, the book currently is number 1 in the category on Amazon of Christian leadership. So a lot of Christians obviously have gotten sufficiently intrigued. This was the most famous rabbi, I would argue, probably since Maimonides, 800 years ago.
Indeed.
So not surprisingly, there are non-Jews who've heard about him, and they want to know what made this man special, and is there something from him that we can learn? So I wanted to introduce that element to the Rebbe, and the fact that the sales have gotten off to a very strong start makes me feel that I've been blessed to help play a role in filling a need that was really there.
Mm-hmm. My wife said that this book actually shouldn't be in the biography section. It should actually be in the self-help section, because of learning about the Rebbe and what the Rebbe wanted people to do and how people should even think about themselves. It seems that your book has accomplished this, and it's indeed, Rabbi Joseph Plushkin, a very monumental work and wish you continued success.
Thank you. That is so kind. And tell your wife, I'm greatly indebted to her for that comment, because it echoes what I feel. There's a section in the book called Seven Virtues, which are teachings of the Rebbe that anybody can incorporate into their lives. And from my perspective, that was a very essential part of the book.
Great. Okay, we're out of time. We're actually over time, but this has been fascinating and wonderful and very entertaining. The book is Rebbe by Joseph Plushkin, The Life and Teachings of Menachem M. Schneerson Lubavitcher Rebbe, the most influential rabbi in modern history. Thank you so much for coming on, and keep us surprised.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to meeting.
Take care.
In person.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility, with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. That was actually fascinating. Probably one of the longest interviews I've allowed to occur over here on the show. We blew right through most of our music time, but so of all the choices of music I'm going to play the Klezmer piece, because when I don't play Klezmer, I usually hear about it on www.rabbifinman.com. People call and send me mail that say, you didn't play any klezmer this week, Rabbi Finman. So if we have time for two, well, one of them are going to be a klezmer. And if we don't have time for one, it's going to be klezmer. This is L'Orchestre Klezmer from Brussels, Belgium. And the song is simply called a doodle-love, which means a ditty, I guess, would be a good translation of the word doodle. Let's listen in. Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. This week, we are reading the portion of Chukas. It is in chapter 19 of the book of Numbers and following. There's a couple of things mentioned in it. First of all, it starts with the laws of the red cow, the red heifer, which is used in the purification of someone who came in contact with a dead body. Aaron, Moses' brother, died in this week's portion. His passing, it says, was commemorated by the entire Jewish people, which nobody else had that merit, that the entire Jewish people mourned the passing of Aaron, even Moses. And by Moses, it says that when Moses died, that the Bnei Yisrael, the men, mourned Moses' passing for a month. Moses was, he's called Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our teacher, and he spent most of his time teaching men, and women not so much. But Aaron's big deal, we mentioned before about Rabbi Akiva and Hillel, so there was this statement that is attributed to Hillel about loving your fellow as yourself. That Hillel is quoted as saying, "Hevi talmidim shel Aaron hakayin." You should be as one of the disciples of Aaron. Ayev shalom, roidev shalom, ayev es abrius makarbim latera. He loved peace. He pursued peace. He loved all creatures and brought them closer to the Torah, brought them closer to Judaism, brought them closer to God. If you would ask anybody in the desert, who is your best friend? They would say, why, Aaron. And if you ask them, and who do you think is Aaron's best friend? They would say, well, with the relationship that I have, Aaron's best friend must be me. Now, that's really hard to do with more than a handful of people. But if you're talking about a population of 600,000 families, that Aaron was best friends with every single one of them. You talk about taking interest in the individual. Aaron would hear that there's two people having a fight. And having a fight in Judaism means that two people don't talk to each other for 3 days because they don't like what the other one did. That's the definition of having a fight. He'd go to one of them and say, you know, I know the other person and he's confided in me that he's really embarrassed about this whole thing, and he really, really wants to get back on speaking terms with you, but he's embarrassed. He says, please, you know, I'm your good friend. You make the first step. And Aaron would talk to this person, would convince him, okay, I'll make the first step. Then he would run to the other person and say, you know, I know the other person, and he's really sorry about it, and he really wants to make amends. He really wants to be on good terms, but he's embarrassed. I think you should make the first step. And you convince him. And then that's called pursuing peace. Because in actuality, people really don't want to fight with somebody else. People aren't looking for fights. People really like it better when there is peace. In fact, the Almighty says, if there's discord, disharmony, I'm out. when things aren't living, when people are living in peace, we make a vessel for godliness to come into this world. That was what Aaron wanted to do. To the extent, he loved even that person. That the best thing that you could say about that person was, well, God went to the trouble of creating him. Nothing more than just say like a bria, a creature. The guy's a creature. He's got nothing going, you don't see anything. Because how do you measure a soul? How do you measure, like we said before, you can't call somebody rachuk. You can't say somebody has no background. Because we don't know. We all go back to the same place. We all start with God. That's the beginning point with all of us. Speaking of beginning points, we got to take a commercial break, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Hey, Herschel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? RabbiFinman.com, www.RabbiFinman.com. I make it easy. You don't have to go looking for contact pages, none of that stuff. I hate that. You know, just not saying anything bad about HarperCollins, but their contact page was buried under about four layers until I finally was able to find just the general number. No, RabbiFinman.com, right on the homepage. There's a link. Contact us. We want to make life easy for everybody. You got a problem? I can't solve everybody's problems, but an inquiry, something, a point, a comment, constructive criticism. I love constructive criticism. How to make the show better. RabbiFinman.com, right on the homepage. What else is on RabbiFinman.com? Well, you'll find the E-Parsha, the U-Parsha, and the Hasidic U-Story, which are various media of yours truly conveying Torah and Judaism in hopefully an entertaining and educational manner to enlighten you and make your life easier and make you a better person too. There's also, classes. Yeah, some of the classes. You should really check out some of the classes, if I do say so myself, the classes page. There's also the very important donation page. It is the 22nd of June. We have 8 days left to pay for June. We are, I don't like using the word miserable, but we're far away from paying our bill for June so far. So we need you to step up. You step up every single month. It's amazing. I am always humbled by the outpouring, and it always seems to get there just at the right time. So go to RabbiFinman.com. Go to the donations page, click on it, and pick a number, insert a number. They're all good. Any number you come up with, it's gladly accepted and gratefully appreciated. And Jewish Hour is a program of a 501(c) corporation, so it's tax deductible if you need such things. It is a charitable program, so it'll count against your tithes. Jews do take 10% and give it away, as we've spoken about many times. And giving charity and giving away money to needy causes is a good source for making money. It's a good way to invest money because the Almighty promises sometimes four times return, sometimes 10 times the return. I'm not making any promises, any guarantees. You have to take that up with the Almighty, but it's a good place to put your money. People listening will appreciate it. You'll appreciate it. We'll appreciate it. And the world will be a better place, God willing, with your help. Don't like doing internet endeavors with credit cards? I understand fully. Drop your donation into an envelope, put a stamp on it, and send it to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Quick story concerning the Lubavitcher Rebbe. From a period of the last few years of the Rebbe's life, after the Rebbe's wife passed away and before he had a stroke, the Rebbe would stand on Sunday, late morning, usually would start, and for several hours, and would give people a dollar to give to charity, and then people could ask for anything that was bothering them or they wanted for from the Rebbe. I went several times. I have a small stack of such dollars. And even just to get a bracha, just the blessing, bracha v'hatzlacha, you should be blessed and you should have success, was enough for me in most instances. I once took a group of people to go visit the Rebbe for dollars. And there was a young man who wanted a blessing to get into an American medical school. He had applied to, I don't know, a dozen schools, and the only school he'd been accepted in was Granada, and there was only one school left. And he was really nervous about getting into that one school because he really didn't want to go to Granada. He really wanted to go to the American one. And so he went to the Rebbe, and he presented himself and said, Rebbe, I need a bracha. Or bracha, Rebbe, can you give me a bracha, a blessing, to get into an American school? The Rebbe gave him a look. And I remember this look. I shudder just remembering this look. It's like the Rebbe did, I would call it a CIP. This guy's soul was just washed away when the Rebbe gave him a look. And the Rebbe said to him, we should hear good news. And then the Rebbe leaned in and intensified the look so that I felt the look and said, Beruchnius, the spirituality. The man was accepted to an American medical school. He is now a successful doctor living not in the United, not in the Detroit area, but he's a successful doctor living elsewhere, a prominent doctor, as a matter of fact. And he is the father of, I believe, four or five, maybe six kids by now who attend religious day schools, and he himself is a religious person, all because of the look of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. That's going to do it. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week, and we hope to see you again next week. Take care.
Say a special blessing on a cup that's filled with wine.